Okay, good morning and welcome everybody to Bio 241. It's the first lecture after spring break. It's April 10th. We're going to finish up endocrine system today. Here's the sign-in sheet. Please sign the sign-in sheet. I didn't put the class or the date, so you go ahead and put that on the very first page right there and just sign in, please, so I know you're still interested in the class and attending so I don't drop you. Okay, and if I do drop you, then you can say, "Hey, but I was there. I signed in." So that's your receipt that you're here in case I make a silly mistake. Okay? All right. So here's the schedule coming up. We're done with spring break. All right, so we're going to have a lecture today and then exam number 3 on chapters 9, 10, and 11 on Thursday. All right, so everybody's aware of that. All right, so let's see. Where were we? I think we're just starting to talk about the thyroid gland. And the thyroid gland produces a hormone that we see right here. We talked about this slide already. Let me get into slideshow mode. Yeah, I know. We're way past this, but I just wanted you to see. Oh, here it is. Visible. All right, I just wanted you to see what this chemical compound looked like. Look at these aromatic rings right here that makes thyroxine. Remember, there's two forms of thyroxine, whether it has four iodines on this molecule or three. If there's four, it's called tetraiodothreonine or thyroxine. If there are three, then it's triiodothreonine. And no one, of course, really ever says that because it's just too much of a mouthful, so we just say T3 or T4. Okay? And what I want you to visualize on this diagram right here is that this hormone, because of these aromatic rings, makes it relatively hydrophobic. All right, so it's more of a lipophilic kind of compound. All right, so where would you have receptors for a compound like this that is hydrophobic? Inside the cell, yeah, because it can get through the cell membrane, right? It can diffuse through cell membranes. And that's because of these ring structures right here. All right, so let's zoom. I want to close your eyes because I'm going to zoom through a bunch of slides that we talked about already and get to thyroid gland, adrenal gland. We're done with. Yeah, so I think we left off right about here last time. Okay, and so the thyroid gland is in the cervical region. It's in your neck, anterior neck. And so here is the larynx, and you can see the thyroid cartilage, which was named after the thyroid gland. Yeah, hi. Oh, is it way back here on the pituitary?
The last slide I had was 1139.
Okay, let's finish up pituitary gland. Well, it looks like we just kind of started pituitary. Oh, but I drew some things on the board. I remember drawing some things on the board. Maybe, maybe. Okay, but remember, okay, pituitary gland. There are two main regions of the pituitary gland. Let me go to one and one so you don't have to strain your neck. And I tell you what, I'm going to turn some of these lights down. Okay. Do you need more lights back there to work on your sign? You're good. You're good? Okay. All right. So here's that pituitary gland. What are the major parts of the pituitary? How many are there for this class? Yeah, there's two. There's anterior and posterior pituitary. Right? The anterior is really made out of endocrine tissue, and the posterior pituitary really is nervous tissue. And they're controlled by the hypothalamus that we see right here. All right, so the posterior pituitary, sometimes we call it the neurohypophysis. Hypophysis is just another name for pituitary because it's really nervous tissue. There are axons that move from the hypothalamus down into the posterior pituitary. So these are tracts that we have in the infundibulum. And when the cell bodies up in the hypothalamus receive threshold stimulus, then an action potential comes down through the tract. And when that action potential reaches the axon terminus, those neurons will then release two hormones. Right? And actually, you could consider them neurotransmitters because they're released by neurons. Right? But those neurotransmitters are picked up by the circulatory system, so they're hormones that go throughout the whole body. So maybe the best way to talk about those compounds is that they are neurohormones. Right? Okay, and there are two. Does anybody remember the names of the two that are released from the posterior lobe? ADH and oxytocin, right. The anterior pituitary is controlled a little bit differently. There are releasing hormones from the hypothalamus that get picked up by a capillary in the hypothalamus, transported by a portal blood vessel, and they leave the circulatory system with a second capillary bed in the anterior pituitary, and those cause the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. What do we call a blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back to back without going through the heart? That's a portal blood system, right? So there is a hypophyseal portal blood system between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. So on this slide, we see the tracts coming from the supraoptic and paraventricular nucleus in the hypothalamus. Okay, and when action potentials reach the axon terminus, they release ADH and oxytocin. And did we talk about what the effects of ADH and oxytocin are if a target tissue has a receptor? Okay, oxytocin is a smooth muscle stimulant. It causes some smooth muscles to contract, right? Specifically the uterus during parturition and smooth muscle around the glandular tissue of the breast for nursing. We call that the milk letdown reflex. Okay, antidiuretic hormone has the opposite effect as a diuretic. What would a diuretic do? It would make you pee. An antidiuretic does what? Makes you conserve water, okay? So it helps maintain fluid balance in your body. All right, here is the portal blood system. Oh yeah, we did talk about that last time. Okay, and here are some releasing factors that are transported by the portal blood system to the anterior pituitary. And then the next slide shows, right, the types of hormones that are released from the anterior pituitary. Prolactin. Okay, prolactin causes maturation of breast tissue, okay, during gestation, so that after parturition, the breast is mature and it can produce a competent milk product to nourish young. Growth hormone, right, causes bone and muscle and adipose tissue growth, so that's necessary for development. We have thyroid stimulating hormone, which is a trophic hormone, which goes to the thyroid gland, which causes the thyroid gland to grow, but also to produce a competent hormone, which we call thyroid hormone. I just showed you what that thyroid hormone looks like. What were the two forms of thyroid hormone that get released as a result of TSH? T3 and T4, right? That works for me, right? And adrenal corticotropic hormone from the anterior pituitary again maintains the adrenal cortex and causes the secretion of mineralocorticoids and glucocorticoids. A mineralocorticoid that we will become familiar with is aldosterone, and some glucocorticoids would be like cortisone and cortisol. Maybe we'll talk about that when we get to the adrenal cortex. And then gonadotropins, and notice this is a plural term right here because there are two. You have FSH and LH. Both the male and female have FSH and LH, even though our gonads are quite different, and a gonad is either an ovary or a testes, and a gonad produces gametes or a sex cell. The sex cell in the testes would be a sperm. What would be a sex cell produced by an ovary? An egg, that's right. Okay, so follicle stimulating hormone causes the maturation of an egg and a follicle in an ovary. Okay, and FSH in the male causes or stimulates the production of sperm. So it's kind of analogous functions, right? FSH in the female compared to the male. But it helps produce gametes, whether they're eggs or sperm. LH is a little bit different in male and female. LH produces ovulation when a follicle is mature. When an egg is mature, it causes ovulation of that egg so that it can enter the female reproductive system through the fallopian tubes right here, all right? But LH in the male, okay, causes certain cells to produce testosterone, all right? So that's its main function because there is no analog function of ovulation in the male. There's no such thing as ovulation in the male. But LH does tell certain cells within the testes to produce testosterone. Okay, so here is just a list of all those hormones. We went over it pretty fast. I think maybe we did a little introduction to that last time. Okay, and the anterior pituitary is controlled not by action potentials coming down a track from the hypothalamus, but from releasing factors or inhibiting factors from the hypothalamus. And I'm sure I kind of drew that on the board. Okay, so for instance, one of the hormones from the anterior pituitary is called thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH. All right, so how does the anterior pituitary know when to release thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH? Let's see if I got a marker that works. So anterior pituitary is going to release TSH. I'll abbreviate it anterior pituitary. Just kind of put a table right here. Anterior pituitary is going to release TSH. How does the anterior pituitary know to release thyroid stimulating hormone? It gets a signal from the hypothalamus. So let's put hypothalamus right here. All right, and I'll abbreviate it. The hypothalamus is going to release a hormone that's going to go directly, according to our slide right here, to the anterior pituitary via this portal blood vessel. And what's the name of the hormone from the hypothalamus? It's going to be TSH-RH or RF, either one. So books use those terms interchangeably. I don't know if anybody's ever going to settle on one or the other, but TSH-RF, releasing factor, that will cause the release of TSH. Okay, and here's another anterior pituitary hormone, and it is ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone. Causes the adrenal cortex to grow and be maintained and secrete hormones. Right? How does the anterior pituitary know when to release adrenal corticotropic hormone? Because it gets a signal from the hypothalamus. Oh, I'm wrecking the convention that we have right here. Probably I should have fitted in right here, but hypothalamus, the hypothalamus is going to release ACTH, what? Dash RF or RH. Okay, and when adrenal corticotropic hormone reaches the set point, guess what happens? Then the hypothalamus stops releasing adrenal corticotropic hormone releasing factor so that homeostasis is maintained in a nice negative feedback loop. Okay, so you can do the same thing for gonadotropins and growth hormone and all of the other hormones from the anterior pituitary. And here shows some feedback loops. So here is a hormone that we didn't talk about on the board, but we talked about it on some slides, and that is the gonadotropins. How many kinds of gonadotropins are there? There are two, and you know their names? Follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, and you know some of the functions of these two hormones right here. They come from the anterior pituitary. What causes release of these gonadotropins from the anterior pituitary? There's a signal. And that signal comes from the hypothalamus. You see it on the slide right here. And it is gonadotropin releasing hormone. Or you could say releasing factor. Don't care. We abbreviate that GnRH because gonadotropin is kind of a big, unwieldy word. Right, so GnRH from the hypothalamus causes secretion of FSH and LH from the anterior pituitary. And these get picked up by the capillary bed in the anterior pituitary, carried everywhere in the body, but they have an effect on the gonads because why? They have receptors for FSH and LH, right? And then they cause various effects within the gonads here, spermatogenesis, right, or ovulation in the female. And you can see some feedback loops. Because sex steroids are also secreted by the gonads as a result of these gonadotropins right here, estrogens and androgen. Right? They get into the blood, they go back to the anterior pituitary, right? And this will inhibit the responsiveness to GnRH. So if these levels of estrogens and androgens are high, right, then that's going to inhibit the sensitivity of the anterior pituitary to GnRH. Right, so as these levels increase, then this is a nice feedback mechanism which will maintain estrogens and androgens at their particular set point. Right, so as estrogens and androgens increase, this loop right here causes a decrease in the level. So this response, how does this response feed back to this initial stimulus right here? It subtracts from it, right? And so that's a nice negative feedback loop. So this is what we would call a short loop negative feedback, right, from the gonads to the anterior pituitary, but that's not the only feedback mechanism. These sex steroids will also have an effect on the hypothalamus, so that when these levels are starting to rise above normal, here we have a feedback mechanism, and that's going to cause a reduction in the secretion of GnRH from the hypothalamus, which will then bring estrogens and androgens back down to their normal levels. All right, so here we have another nice negative feedback mechanism, right, and we call this a long loop feedback mechanism. And that's just a way to maintain homeostasis or the proper levels of estrogens and androgens in the body. Okay, so since the hypothalamus is part of the brain, it receives signals from everywhere in the brain. Okay, so these can affect secretions from the anterior pituitary, right? So emotional states, psychological stress can affect the release of gonadotropins and adrenal hormones from the adrenal cortex, because the hypothalamus is a part of the brain. It's all integrated together. All right, posterior pituitary. Well, we said two hormones, antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. We kind of talked about oxytocin pretty well, right? But here's something about ADH that we didn't talk about yet, and that is it has another name. And another name for antidiuretic hormone is vasopressin. All right, so a pressor agent is one that will increase blood pressure. Right, it will cause contraction of blood vessels. All right, so think of a water balloon, and if you squeeze on a water balloon, what's going to happen to the pressure inside that balloon? Is it going to go up or go down or stay the same as you squeeze on it? Yeah, and if you squeeze down too hard, what's going to happen? It's going to pop. Exactly right. All right, so vasopressin will cause blood vessels to vasoconstrict, and when that happens, blood pressure increases. All right, so antidiuretic hormone is also another important mechanism for controlling your blood pressure as a result, because it regulates vasoconstriction. But there's another effect too that I want you to appreciate with ADH or vasopressin, and that is if you measure the pressure in a tire on your car and it's too low, the tire pressure is too low, what do you do to the air in that tire? Do you take air out or do you put air in to get the tire pressure back up? You put air back in, right? So in this particular case, now use that analogy on a person. So if a person's blood pressure is beginning to become low or is low, should we take blood volume out of the person or increase their blood volume? You increase their blood volume to increase their blood pressure if their blood pressure is getting too low. And that's what antidiuretic hormone does. If you don't lose water by producing urine, then that fluid stays in your body and that has a tendency to maintain your blood pressure. Okay, so this is a very important mechanism for controlling blood pressure from these two effects, because you maintain blood volume and it also causes blood vessels to vasoconstrict. Okay, and here you can see the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract carrying action potentials from the paraventricular and the supraoptic nucleus down into the posterior pituitary. And of course, this supraoptic nucleus right here just means what? It's pretty easy once you see that. It's just right above the optic chiasma right here, right? And then the paraventricular nucleus just means that there are nuclei on either side of the third ventricle in this part of the brain and within the hypothalamus. Okay, the adrenal gland. The adrenal gland, like the pituitary, has got some different components to it, right? The pituitary gland has the anterior part and the posterior part. The adrenal gland is a little bit different. It's not anterior and posterior, but there's a difference between the cortex and the medulla. And we talked about the medulla already, because preganglionic sympathetic fibers go into the adrenal medulla, right? And when they are stimulated, these chromaffin cells then release norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood, right? And then they act as sympathetic agents everywhere in the body, or at least tissues that have adrenergic receptors. All right, but we haven't really talked about the cortex yet, which is this layer right here, and it has some subzones to it as well. And I don't think I ask you on a test any of these different zones, unless there's a question at the end of the chapter or an online question, okay? But I just want you to realize that there are different zones within the adrenal cortex, like the glomerulosa, and we got the capsule right here, but that's not too significant for this class. All right, then the fasciculata and the reticularis, and these different layers produce different kinds of hormones. So just be aware that there is a difference in the structure of the adrenal cortex, which produces different kinds of hormones. Okay, so we're done talking about the medulla, but the cortex is controlled by adrenal corticotropic hormone. So that's a tropic hormone, which causes growth of the adrenal cortex and secretion of some hormones. Where does ACTH come from? This is like a little mini quiz. Where does ACTH come from? The pituitary gland, and as a matter of fact, which part? The anterior pituitary. How does the anterior pituitary know when to release ACTH? Because when it has receptors for ACTH-RH from the hypothalamus. Okay. All right, so when ACTH from the anterior pituitary reaches the adrenal cortex, okay, it's going to release cortisol, which inhibits glucose utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis. All right, that's going to have a tendency to increase blood glucose concentration, right, because your body won't be able to use the glucose that's there. And if there are pyruvates or lactates running around in your body, then, right, your cells are going to have a tendency to join those molecules together to make even more glucose, which ends up in the blood. All right, so this is what we call a glucocorticoid. So cortisol is a glucocorticoid. Here's an example of a mineralocorticoid, and that is aldosterone. It has an effect on the kidneys as well, sort of like antidiuretic hormone. It stimulates the kidneys to resorb sodium from filtrate, from urine. All right, and when you keep your body salty, guess what happens to water as a result? Yeah, so you have a tendency to retain water, right? And as your blood volume increases, what happens to blood pressure as well? It goes up as well. So here's another mechanism, all right, that is involved in regulating blood pressure. All right, the other key thing that for sure I want you to memorize, sometime during this class we're going to talk about it again, is the effect of aldosterone on the kidney with respect to sodium and to potassium. And what would you say? Does aldosterone have the same effect on sodium and potassium or opposite effects? You're right. It's opposite effects. Okay, so that's going to be something that's easy to memorize. Right, so it causes the resorption. You retain sodium in your body, but what about potassium? You're going to secrete or lose potassium. All right, so we're going to talk about this mechanism a lot of different times, but in maybe 3 years from now or 4 years from now, when you have a board exam question about aldosterone right here, because it's a real important hormone, what's going to be the correct answer? It's going to increase the reabsorption of sodium and potassium. Is it going to cause the secretion of sodium and potassium from the kidney? Or is it going to have, when you look at the question, opposite effects? That's the easy thing to remember. So just remember, it's going to have opposite effects on sodium and potassium. Okay. And the reason why that is has to do with a little pump that we looked at way, way, way back in this class, and that was the sodium-potassium ATP pump. Okay. That little sodium-potassium ATP pump, how did it pump sodium and potassium? In the same direction or opposite directions? Opposite direction. So we're going to look at the molecular reason for why that happens in the kidney, one of the last slides in the class. Okay, but just remember, aldosterone causes opposite effects of sodium and potassium resorption in your body. Okay, and the adrenal glands also produce some supplementary sex steroids, and in particularly not estrogens, but androgens. All right, so even females have a fair amount of androgens, which is a male sex steroid in their body. And you might ask, well, why the heck is that? Because it's necessary for sex drive. And it's also necessary for aggressive behavior. Well, actually, that's just my, I don't know if I could cite any studies that show that, but probably so. And what gender typically would you imagine is the most aggressive, males or females? Oh, you said that so fast, like without thinking, males. But in my opinion, it's not. It's females. And in what sense? And in sense of protecting young, right? So aggressive behavior in females would really be startling, right? When, if you were ever to walk upon a female bear in the woods, right, that had little cubs, that there would be no negotiating with that female, right? You would be lucky to get out alive. Okay, so I wouldn't just necessarily say males in that particular case. Okay, so let's look at some of the hormones from the adrenal cortex. And you can see the different zones right here. This is not an exam figure, but what's really important for you to know is what class of hormones are mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, and sex steroids. These are all lipid molecules. Okay, they're steroids, and what is the precursor molecule for all steroid hormones in your body? It is cholesterol. That's right. So cholesterol then is modified right in the glomerulosa. It's converted into a number of different forms right here. And finally, aldosterone is produced. Okay, and in the fasciculata, you can see the pathways are a little bit similar. Okay, but the fasciculata and reticularis produce the glucocorticoids, the corticosterone and cortisol. And even these precursors right here then can be used to make androgens, all right, in everybody. Okay, but I want you to see that the precursor molecule is cholesterol, so we definitely need some cholesterol in our body. All right, the adrenal medulla, you know, I think we've pretty much talked about this already when we looked at autonomic nervous system, right, but the adrenal medulla, the cells there are called chromaffin cells, and they receive innervation from preganglionic sympathetic fibers. All right, but let me just set the stage a little bit. For an autonomic outflow pathway from the central nervous system to an effector organ, and what are the effector organs of an autonomic system? How many are there? There's three, and they are what? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. How many nerves does it take to get from central nervous system to an effector organ for an autonomic outflow pathway? Two, yeah, a preganglionic and a postganglionic. Okay, so the adrenal medulla acts like a postganglionic neuron in an autonomic outflow pathway, right? It's not a neuron that sends action potentials any place, but when it gets stimulated from the preganglionic sympathetic fiber, right, then it releases epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, and that goes into the circulatory system like all hormones do, and they can bind to adrenergic receptors anywhere in the body, and it causes the fight or flight response. All right, and remember, the sympathetic nervous system is characterized by a divergence of signals and a convergence of signals. We call it mass activation. So the sympathetic nervous system can't really go to one part of your body and activate sympathetic fibers. Your whole body becomes activated, and this is one of the reasons why. A nice backup system. All right, and so when you're presented with a life-threatening circumstance, right, you have increased respiratory rate, right, so you perfuse your lungs with oxygen so that you can inhale more oxygen, heart rate increases, cardiac output increases. We're going to talk about these things coming up pretty soon in the class. There's a general vasoconstriction because there are some veins in your body that dilate, blood pools in those veins, okay, when you're not exercising. Right, but when you're presented with a stressful circumstance, then those veins should constrict and return all that blood to your circulatory system, to your heart. Okay, that's what we call increases venous return. And when that happens, your heart gets stronger and you actually pump more blood and more oxygen and nutrients throughout your whole body when that happens. All right, but you also need to make ATP. How can you make ATP? From glucose, for instance, right? So the epinephrine and norepinephrine, and actually we had a nice slide a couple of slides ago how through adrenergic receptors, alpha and beta adrenergic receptors, increase glycogenolysis, that's the breakdown of glycogen, right? And then there is a phosphatase that chops off the phosphate and makes just simple glucose that can leave liver cells, and that increases blood glucose for availability in all the tissues in your body. And lipolysis, it also stimulates lipolysis. And that increases ATP via what kind of pathway? How can a fatty acid produce ATP? What metabolic pathway is used in your body for making ATP from fatty acids? Yeah, beta oxidation. And probably you could even recall the organelle that's responsible for that. Where does that take place? In mitochondria. Beta oxidation takes place in mitochondria. I think that was on the last test. Okay. All right, so over summer, I see you guys are going to break out your anatomy and physiology books and just go over this stuff again, because this is all just really nice stuff for you to know for the rest of your life. Okay. All right, thyroid gland. Here we have the larynx, and then here down here is the trachea. This is the beginning of the lower airway, and just anterior to the larynx is the thyroid gland, and as a matter of fact, here is a piece of cartilage of the larynx that's named after the thyroid gland. Here's the thyroid cartilage, right? And it's very prominent in males, so just below that, and then on either side, kind of like a butterfly, is the thyroid gland. It secretes competent thyroid hormone, which is T3 and T4, which sets a basic metabolic rate in people. It can make them very sluggish if you're deficient in these levels. It can make you very hyperactive if T3 and T4 are above normal, right? And it's also needed, these compounds are also needed for development and growth, along with growth hormone. Okay, so that's what comes from the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland consists of little pockets or spheres of cells that we call follicles, thyroid follicles. The outer layer is made up of cells, kind of like an epithelium. Okay, remember, epithelium makes glands, so it's consistent with our understanding of what glandular tissue is all about. These cells synthesize T4. And the interior of these spherical-shaped structures that we call follicles, it's filled with a fluid, which is what we call a colloid. And it's rich in protein. And these proteins will kind of act like a detergent, because T3 and T4, remember, are hydrophobic molecules. They don't like to dissolve in water. So these proteins then, which are just binding proteins, solubilize T3 and T4 and act as a reservoir for T3 and T4 until the thyroid gland is called to secrete it. Okay, so what hormone causes the thyroid gland to secrete thyroid hormone? Thyroid stimulating hormone. And where does thyroid stimulating hormone come from? It comes, what structure? The anterior pituitary. And what causes the anterior pituitary to release thyroid stimulating hormone? TSH, RH, or TSH, RF, right? It's the same compound. Okay, but don't forget, for thyroid hormones, for T3 and T4, we need some iodine. All right, so we have iodide in our diet, okay, at least in most diets, and that gets absorbed into our blood. It's transported into the follicle. So here's a follicle. It's just a ring of cells right here with colloid on the inside. So these cells take up iodide, and it's secreted into the colloid where it's oxidized into iodine, which is I2, and then it's attached to the tyrosines, right, of the nascent thyroid hormone. Right, which then is bound to thyroglobulin, because T3 and T4 really don't like to dissolve within the colloid right here. All right, so this is the storage form for T3 and T4. When thyroid stimulating hormone comes around, there are receptors then which causes hydrolysis of T3 and T4 from the binding proteins, and that causes the release of T3 and T4 into the plasma. But remember, T3 and T4 doesn't really like to dissolve in plasma because it's a water material. So there are other carrier proteins within plasma that bind T3 and T4. It kind of acts like a detergent once again and carries T3 and T4 in a bound form throughout the circulatory system. Right, so there's an equilibrium. T3 is binding to this carrier protein, and then sometimes it dissociates. Sometimes T4 binds to the carrier protein. Sometimes it dissociates. Right, so think of this according to the Le Chatelier principle. Right, if a bunch of cells absorb T3 from the blood, what happens to the amount of T3 that's bound to this protein carrier? Then it kind of gets forced off, right, to build up just a standard concentration of T3, just free T3 in the blood. All right, or if T3 is not being absorbed by cells, right, and there's a buildup of T3 in plasma, guess what happens? Then according to Le Chatelier's principle, then more of this carrier protein is bound with T3. So it acts like a little buffer for maintaining free levels of T3 and T4 in the blood. Okay. So in order to have a competent T3 or T4, what's the element that's necessary? Iodine. That's right. Okay. So in the absence of dietary iodide, then a competent T3 and T4 can't be produced. All right. So if the thyroid gland can't make thyroid hormone, guess what parts of the body become really worried? Because there are parts of the brain and pituitary can monitor thyroid hormone. All right, and that is the hypothalamus then starts to increase thyroid releasing factor right here. Anterior pituitary is going to release more thyroid stimulating hormone. That's going to go to the thyroid gland. Thyroid stimulating hormone, remember, causes the release of T3 and T4, but it also stimulates the growth of the thyroid gland. Right, so thyroid stimulating hormone is going to cause the thyroid gland to grow and grow and grow because you need a lot of structure to produce thyroid hormone. But since the thyroid gland doesn't have the necessary precursors, it can't make thyroid hormone. So the anterior pituitary and hypothalamus are going to tell the thyroid gland even harder, even more, to get busy and make thyroid hormone. Right? And the thyroid gland is going to grow and grow and grow, but without iodine, can it make thyroid hormone? It can't. Okay? So I think this is a really good exam figure right here. Okay? Because it shows, right, what happens when we have adequate or inadequate levels of iodine in our diet. If there's adequate levels, right, then a competent T3 and T4 product are made, right, and that is measured by the anterior pituitary. And this feeds back in a negative fashion so that the thyroid gland maintains its normal size and secretes normal levels of T3 and T4. But if there is no iodine in the diet or an inadequate amount, right, then the thyroid gland is producing very low levels of T3 and T4. This goes to the anterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary is going to say what? Oh, levels of T3 and T4 are way too low. Let's stimulate the thyroid gland to produce some. So it releases thyroid stimulating hormone. That causes hypertrophy of the thyroid gland. So it's going to grow and grow and grow and grow. But without iodine, it still can't produce a competent thyroid hormone. Right? So then the anterior is going to even secrete more TSH. All right? So what happens then? This is a... So we almost have like a positive feedback loop taking place right here. So the thyroid gland is going to grow and grow and grow and get very big. We don't see this very often anymore, but sometimes in other countries we do, less advanced countries that don't have iodine in their diet. Where do we get iodine from in our diet around here? Salt. It's hard to buy salt that isn't iodinated. Okay, and that prevents the development of this hypertrophied thyroid gland, which is what we call a goiter. Okay, and you might see somebody walking on the streets with a very enlarged neck like this, right? So that could be goiter, but what else could be causing that thyroid gland to grow? Especially maybe if it's only on one side. What could that be? Maybe that could be a thyroid cancer. Right, so if you see a bilateral development of the thyroid gland, that could be a pretty good indication of goiter. The whole thyroid gland is being stimulated into growing, but if it's unilateral just on one side, then that could be a thyroid gland cancer of some kind. But of course, it has to be diagnosed properly. Okay, so a lot of maladies, if you notice them bilaterally, it could be due to some metabolic disorder, but if there is a hyperplasia just on one side of the body, then that would be a pretty good indication that some other kind of disease process is taking place, like cancer, for instance. Okay. Parathyroid hormone. There are glands. Do we have a picture of a thyroid gland? Not a really good picture. All right, but on the posterior side, which we don't see, here's an anterior side of the thyroid gland. If we look on the posterior side, there are four little nodules that we call the parathyroid glands. They're associated with the thyroid. They don't produce thyroid hormone, but they produce parathyroid hormone. Okay, and parathyroid hormone is stimulated by a decrease in blood calcium levels. Now, what is blood calcium level good for? Or what is calcium good for in your body? Anything at all? Would anybody care? Yes, because you need calcium for strong bones to prevent osteoporosis, which almost everyone in here, if you're lucky enough to live long enough, will have to deal with. Okay? So that's important. But what else is calcium important for? Muscle contraction, which we're going to talk about a lot in the next chapter, and also synaptic transmission. All right? So those are really important things. So when blood calcium starts to decrease, that's really important to bring calcium blood levels back up to a normal range, maintaining homeostasis. All right? So parathyroid hormone acts on bones to dissolve bones away to make sure that blood calcium levels maintain within a normal range. All right, so here is a nice illustration of how this happens. So decreasing blood calcium levels stimulate the parathyroids. Right, so there are receptors for calcium in the parathyroid glands. When it decreases, parathyroid hormone is secreted. Right, and there are receptors in the kidney and receptors in bone. In bone, parathyroid hormone causes certain cells to become activated. What kind of cells are activated? What kind of bone cells do you know about? You got osteocytes. What else do you have? Osteoblasts. And we're talking about, in particular, in this case, osteoclasts, right? Because they break bone down. Blasts build bone, clasts break bone down, and mature bone has osteocytes, right? So whenever you hear that term osteo, what does that refer to? Just bone, right? So you might want to put osteoclasts right here. And actually, it's a balance. It adjusts the balance between osteoblasts and osteoclasts so that osteoclastic activity becomes a little accelerated compared to the osteoblasts. So that causes release of calcium right into the blood. And remember, the active form or the real form of calcium in your bones is hydroxyapatite, which is a combination of calcium and phosphate together. So bones is a storage form of calcium and phosphate together. All right, so that's the effect of parathyroid hormone on bones, is to cause the dissolution of bone material to release calcium into the blood. But parathyroid hormone also has an effect on the kidneys, so that when there is calcium in plasma and it ends up in filtrate, it can be resorbed from a kidney tubule and put back into the blood, so you don't lose it in urine. So we call that reabsorption of calcium from filtrate in the kidneys. All right, and when calcium is resorbed from filtrate, that decreases urinary excretion of calcium, of course, and that increases blood calcium. So here is the response to parathyroid hormone, increased blood calcium. What was the stimulus? Decreasing blood calcium. So this is what kind of feedback mechanism? A nice negative feedback mechanism, which normally maintains what? Homeostasis in your body, right? Okay. Okay, the pancreas. The pancreas has two important functions. One is an endocrine function, one is an exocrine function. The exocrine function is to produce digestive enzymes, and the endocrine part is to adjust blood glucose levels. Just like it's important to maintain blood calcium homeostasis, the same thing for blood glucose homeostasis as well. And the pancreas plays an important role because it has glucose receptors, and they're located in islets. There are pockets of cells that form things that almost look like follicles, and then there's cells that are outside of the follicles that form little islands, and somebody named them the islets of Langerhans, and I guess Señor Langerhans was the person that discovered these things using a microscope years and years ago. And notice there are two different kinds of cells. There's beta cells and alpha cells within the pancreas, and they both monitor blood glucose levels, and they secrete different kinds of hormones. All right, alpha cells secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. Right, because glucagon can stimulate glycogenolysis. What the heck is glycogenolysis again? Lysis is what? Breaking something down, and it's breaking down glycogen, and glycogen is the storage form of glucose, right? It's just made, it's just pure glucose, all bound together. And it also, glucagon also stimulates lipolysis. Okay, both of these effects increase blood glucose levels. So glucagon increases blood glucose. Now, what would it make sense to have if glucagon increases blood glucose in terms of maintaining balance and precise control of blood glucose levels? What would it also make sense to have? An antagonistic hormone to glucagon, which is, maybe some of you are familiar with, which is insulin. Okay, and remember, insulin allows, it's the passport that allows glucose to enter many cells in the body. So without insulin signal, glucose can't enter most cells in the body. What happens to those cells that can't take glucose up? Well, they starve to death, right? So that's a very important signal. The beta cells are responsible for secreting insulin, okay, in response to high blood glucose. All right, so when blood glucose is high, insulin is released. Insulin allows cells in your body to take up glucose. What happens to blood glucose levels when all the cells start to take it up from the blood? It goes back down. Okay. Okay, so it promotes entry of glucose into cells. Probably you should think of those GLUT4 transporters in endosomes, right? Insulin also enhances conversion of glucose into glycogen and fat and decreases blood glucose levels. All right, so let's start with a stimulus right here. Increase blood glucose levels. Like, in what kind of condition would your blood glucose increase? When you're in a fasted state or a fed state? When you're in a fed state, okay, blood glucose is going to increase because you're absorbing glucose from the food that you ate. Goes to the beta cells, right, of the pancreatic islets because there are glucose receptors there. When blood glucose increases, the beta cells increase insulin secretion. It gets transported everywhere in the body, and if there are insulin receptors, what kind of receptor is an insulin receptor? Ooh, insulin receptor. What kind of receptor is that? Ion channel? Or what kind of receptor is it? It's located outside the cell. Insulin can't get inside the cell because it's a tyrosine kinase receptor. Did I talk about that? I think I talked about that. Tyrosine kinase, right? So it binds to that receptor. The receptor becomes phosphorylated. And as a result, then it can phosphorylate other proteins inside the cell, especially at tyrosine amino acid residues on those proteins, which then activate a whole bunch of mechanisms that cause the placement or the insertion of GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane that can allow for the facilitated diffusion of glucose across the cell membrane. All right, so let's get back to the scheme right here. Insulin is secreted. It increases cellular uptake of glucose. All right, and when glucose is taken up from the blood, okay, then glucose can enter the liver. And what can the liver do with glucose? Make glycogen out of it. It will store it, right? And even skeletal muscle has some glycogen in it as well. So for liver and skeletal muscle, glucose is going to be converted into glycogen, right? And also in adipose tissue, adipose is going to take up glucose and it's going to convert it into fatty acids and triglyceride. And as a matter of fact, if you take a glucose and chop it in half, then you modify it a little bit, you get a glycerol molecule, which is the backbone for a triglyceride. So this glucose can be used to make fatty acids as well as glycerol, which are the components for triglycerides in adipose tissue. All right, so when these tissues are making glycogen and triglycerides, what happens to blood glucose levels? They go down. What was the initial stimulus? Increased blood glucose. So what kind of feedback mechanism is this? nice because the stimulus and response subtract from each other, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining. Oh, this is getting fun. Yeah, maintaining homeostasis. Just when we're having a lot of fun, that's the last slide of endocrinology. Okay, so I'm sure this is an important exam figure right here as well. All right, so let me remind you about the test on Thursday. You need a clean Scantron. And who am I thinking about when I say you need a clean Scantron? You could raise your hand. But if you're embarrassed to raise your hand, you don't have to. Okay, you should bring a clean Scantron, a pencil, and a good eraser, right? No stray marks, because we're getting to the point of the class. If there's a stray mark on your Scantron, so the Scantron reader can't read it, I will not give you credit for that question, even though you bubbled in the right answer. Okay? So by now, you should really know how to fill in a Scantron without making all kinds of stray marks, because guess what? You're going to be taking board exams on Scantrons, and board exams are really expensive, and if you don't pass a board exam because there's a stray mark on it, then you're just going to be throwing hundreds of dollars away, plus your time. Plus you can't work either if you don't pass the board exam. So that will really cost you. All right, and what else? A picture ID. All right, you need a picture ID. And also, please put your test in the correct pile, so that I can get it into Blackboard that afternoon. So I'll grade them right away. All right, so before you go, any questions on these last couple chapters that we've been talking about? No, looking good. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign it. And when you do, you are free to leave class because this is a hybrid class, right? You have a lot of stuff on line to practice. Okay, let me turn my microphone off.